Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hitler and Poland, How the Independence of One Country Led the World to War in 1939, by Norman Ridley. Narrated by Michael Page. I have issued the command, and I'll have anybody who utters but one word of criticism executed by a firing squad, that our war aim does not consist in reaching certain lines, but in the physical destruction of the enemy. Accordingly, I have placed my Death Head formation in readiness, for the present only in the east, with orders to them to send to death mercilessly and without compassion men, women, and children of Polish derivation and language. Adolf Hitler, speech to Wehrmacht commanders at the Berghof, 22 August 1939. Now, when we talk about countries to our west, we mean Germany. Poland, Romania, and the Baltic states no longer count with us. They have not counted for a long time. We will break these countries apart at a given time and under given circumstances. Marshal Klement Voroshilov, People's Commissariat for the Defense of the USSR, 29 November 1938. Introduction. In 480 BC, the Greek naval commander Themistocles lured the massed warships of the invading Persian fleet into the Straits of Salamis and destroyed them, forcing King Xerxes to abandon his campaign to establish Asian dominion over European soil. The whole of European culture and tradition, which to a very great extent emanates from the Greeks, owes much to this famous victory, and it may be said that, in a similar vein, the Battle of Warsaw in 1920, when Polish forces repelled the Red Army, was comparable by stemming the tide of communism surging out from the newly installed Bolshevik regime in Moscow that threatened to engulf the whole of Europe. The newly created state of Poland was wedged uncomfortably between the two dominant nations of Germany and Russia, with diametrically opposed political philosophies, both of whom plotted continuously to reclaim the lands of Poland that had up until recently been part of the once great but now defunct German and Russian empires. In order to protect itself, Poland was obliged to plot and negotiate with both of its neighbours to try and prevent them from realising its ambitions to eviscerate the country. The United States had been instrumental in the creation of the Polish state after the First World War, but thereafter showed little interest in its predicament. While France was a traditional friend to the Polish peoples and a significant supplier of military aid, its political influence over Eastern European affairs weakened as its own political institutions fell prey to extremes of both left and right, and its immediate post-war dominance waned. Britain seemed interested only in commerce, and that made Germany and Russia significantly more important as trading partners than the predominantly agricultural and technologically backward state of Poland. The decisions taken at Versailles created a Europe that seethed with discontent. It is true to say that the problems faced by the decision-makers were almost beyond solution, and while very many historians, with good reason, have criticized them, few have ventured to suggest what better arrangements over national borders would have been less contentious. The Allies struggled to accommodate U.S. President Woodrow Wilson's concept of the congruity of peoples and their lands, but there was a big gap between ideals and demographic realities. New countries emerged from the chaos of war, and borders were drawn on maps by the victorious powers with arrogance, war-weariness and frustration at the seemingly intractable problems of ethnic divisions, ethnic mixing and ethnic aspirations. There were no historical guidelines, only natural markers such as mountains and rivers, and there were certainly no clear divisions between ethnic peoples who had co-mingled, coexisted, and interbred for many generations within the now defunct imperial dominions. It was inevitable that people who were henceforth obliged to live in a country that did not represent their own nationalistic aspirations would feel cheated and be susceptible to propaganda that told them that they did not have to accept what had been given to them and had every right to rectify what they saw as an unacceptable situation. For the people, it was a sense of national identity that motivated them, but for governments it was a question of security and economics. When borders were contested so fiercely, there was every incentive for governments to take matters into their own hands and literally push the boundaries to create borders that encompassed what they saw as legitimately theirs and contest jurisdiction over border areas that had significant economic importance. It is with some justification that historians contend that the conditions imposed by the victorious Western powers at the end of the First World War would be fertile ground, in which the seeds of discontent were fertilized by revanchism and grew into the fetid jungle of the Second World War. This was nowhere more evident than in the struggle between Germany and Poland to redefine their mutual borders. While Poland fought wars over its disputed eastern borders, the areas stripped from Germany at Versailles were not contested militarily, but were deeply resented by Germany. Both sides mobilized borderland nationalists to fight not only cultural wars by exaggerating the extent to which areas were and always had been part of whichever of the two nations claimed them, but also bloody and brutal terrorist campaigns to achieve ethnic cleansing. Both sides profited politically from border conflicts that allowed them to strengthen their authoritarian regimes, and it was this as much as anything else that prevented enduring solutions to emerge and ensured that bitterness and grievance would endure smouldering in the undergrowth until the winds of war blew on them and fanned them into the inferno. Social engineering projects, violence, expulsions, and forced assimilation would lead to the final genocidal catastrophe of extreme nationalism. Despite the dominance of right-wing politics in Poland, the emergence of Nazi power in Germany did little to bring the countries together, and even drove them further apart as Hitler ramped up his rhetorical assault on the perceived injustices of Versailles, which were soon to translate into territorial expansion over Austria and Czechoslovakia, and with Poland lined up to be the next in line. Britain and France belatedly roused themselves to challenge the Nazi threat, and after the capitulation of the Anschluss and the humiliation of Munich, found themselves in the disagreeable position of seeing no option but to throw its whole weight behind the integrity of the Polish state, if they were ever going to make any sort of stand against Nazi aggression. Chapter 1. National Renewal. The imperial region in the east, as far as it encompasses portions of the earlier Polish state, belongs, because of the facts of history, to Germany. Also, the parts settled by the Poles have become, through German endeavour, the genuine possession of the German people, which can never be renounced. Bamberg Declaration, 17 February 1919. The 12-year-old Polish Queen Jadwiga had married Władysław Jogaila, the Grand Duke of Lithuania, in 1386, thereby giving rise to the long-lasting Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, which might be described as a sort of multinational empire. This period went down in Polish history as the Golden Age, when its political system evolved into an early democratic monarchy in which minorities' rights were protected by law. The Commonwealth was one of the biggest political entities in Europe, as well as one of the most influential, both culturally and politically, until it was dismembered by Russia, Austria, and Prussia after 1772, and ceased to exist altogether in 1795. Although Polish culture endured through language and custom, there was no defined Polish territory until it emerged as an independent state at the end of the First World War. Before partition, the Commonwealth had been governed by a Polish-Lithuanian White Russian aristocracy on federalist and decentralized principles. But after 1795, the Germans grabbed the resource-rich lands of Silesia and controlled the industrial centers of Posen and Breslau, as well as the port city of Danzig. Russia exercised jurisdiction over Warsaw and the eastern regions of historic Poland, while Austro-Hungary occupied Galicia with its culturally important city of Lvov, mineral ore mines and oil fields along the Carpathian mountain range. The Hohenzollern, Habsburg and Romanov empires that between them had ruled the Polish people were quite relaxed about tolerating their thriving nationalist character both within the aristocracy and the peasantry. The kind of national patriotism that fired Polish identity that was emerging placed rather more emphasis upon the people rather than a geographic region as the embodiment of Polishness. While the idea of independent statehood did exist in the minds of many, it was contemplated more in hope than expectation. This sense of collective identity prized real cultural values and proclaimed a vibrant, flourishing consciousness rather than any adherence to a romanticized, nostalgic past. One of the unfortunate effects of this emphasis on Polishness, when the country of Poland was granted independence in 1918, however, was that the new nation embodied a proud sense of self and an almost xenophobic reluctance to allow minority communities within its borders to participate fully in the political life of the country. Throughout the years of partition and occupation, Polish elites in various ways had tried to promulgate a sense of nationhood within the population through various forms of cultural education, and had made great efforts to maintain the Polish language in the school system. National pride resulted in tensions between the Polish and neighbouring Ukrainian communities, however, not only because of religious differences but also because of social disparities. Poles in the Russian Empire had remained proud of their aristocratic traditions but were given little political freedom. The upper classes were suppressed and, for the most part, felt bitter hatred for their rulers, while the peasantry lived a wretched life indifferent both to Polish and Russian masters. The Ukrainian populations in the Russian Empire lacked any significant aristocratic component, and its predominantly peasant culture was progressively and, with little resistance, subsumed by Russification. Where Poles lived alongside Ukrainians, their relations became almost colonial in nature, with Poles as colonizers and Ukrainians the colonized. It was in Austro-Hungary where the Habsburgs had given the greater degree of freedom to all the various ethnic groups within its borders to maintain their own language, cultures and identities, hoping that differences between them would keep them divided and less likely to unite in revolt. While Poles generally found little under Habsburg rule worth protesting about, the state-sponsored movements to encourage the national consciousness of the Ruthenian, Ukrainian populations of eastern Galicia, a territory long felt to be historically Polish, aroused a great deal of resentment. This region, with its capital Lvov, was to become the home of Ukrainian nationalism, despite more than half of its population considering itself to be Polish, and so became the focus of Polish-Ukrainian tensions. After the First World War, with the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, both Poles and Ukrainians had hoped for independence, and while the former were successful, the latter were unable to realize their aims because of the internal divisions and lack of external support. Both nations disputed control of Lvov and the western Ukrainian lands, which were eventually incorporated into the Polish state in 1918. Ukraine up to this time had never been considered to be a political entity, and Lvov had for four centuries, up to 1772, been part of the Polish kingdom before being swallowed up by Austro-Hungary. The province of Galicia, between the Vistula River and the Carpathian Mountains, stretching as far east as Brody, had been created in the late 1700s within the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It contained more than six nationalities, but consisted mostly of Poles and Ukrainians. It achieved a measure of autonomy with its own parliament, with limited powers, in the 1860s, and was allowed to establish several institutions and cultivate its own culture, customs, and religion to become a centre of Polish national activity. It was here, in a region where Polish political parties were operating freely, and Polish language was commonly used in education, administration and the judiciary, that separatist activists fleeing from the Russian authorities took refuge. Polish national celebrations like the anniversaries of the outbreaks of national uprisings or the passing of the Constitution of 3 May 1791 was celebrated uproariously. In contrast to the rest of the annexed Polish territories, the Austro-Hungarian Empire had a policy of respecting local culture and religions on the understanding that all the groups in the empire respected Emperor Franz Joseph as the uniting element of such a large political entity. As a consequence, Polish political activism flourished, and the first Polish and Ukrainian political parties gained parliamentary experience through representation in the Austro-Hungarian administration. From 1871, Polish was restored as the official language at both the province's universities in Kraków and Lwów. International crises that erupted during the first years of the 20th century made a pan-European war a real possibility, and preparing for such an eventuality became a priority for Polish leaders such as Józef Piłsudski, who, in 1908, founded the Union of Active Struggle, ZWC, Związek Walki Czyn, in Lwów. The aim of this organization was to conduct the preparation for a future armed insurrection in the Russian zone of partition. Soon afterwards, paramilitary organizations started to emerge all over Galicia that provided military training for Polish youth, preparing them to fight for independence. By 1914, Eastern Europe was primed to explode with nationalistic fervor, and it was the outbreak of the First World War that precipitated it. Prior to this, the question of Polish independence was not one that exercised the minds of the great powers, but one that existed only for the Poles themselves. The partitioning powers had never shown any willingness to consider the creation of an independent Polish state. When the three great empires that occupied Polish lands were brought down by the war, they left behind a myriad of inextricably mixed populations competing for dominance within disputed borders. Predominantly peasant nations with proud traditions but ruled by aristocrats who owned vast estates, they had been forced to defend themselves for centuries in the spaces separating Western Europe from the vast Asian lands from which invaders had swarmed all through history. When war broke out, however, Poles found themselves in the center of a battleground as German and Russian armies clashed for the first time since 1762, and regional affiliations became uncoupled under the destabilizing effects of war. Mass conscript armies were raised by the opposing forces, both of which tried to outbid the other for the 2 million Poles of conscription age. The war found Poles on both sides of the battle lines fighting each other in a fratricidal catastrophe. On one side, Piłsudski, with Austrian support, was declared commander-in-chief of a Polish national government, albeit one without a country, and marched his forces into Kraków. He aligned himself to the Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire, and Bulgaria, to whose armies he sent volunteer Polish legions. It was to the Austrians, however, that his main support went, and his primary effort was targeted against the Russians. Meanwhile, the Polish National Committee, PNC, Komitet Narodowy Polski, was formed in Warsaw under Roman Dmowski in cooperation with the Triple Entente countries, France, Britain and Russia, to unite the Polish lands and lead Poland toward regaining its independence. Piłsudski and Dmowski represented different sorts of Polishness, and the political divisions they created left Poles in disarray and hindered progress towards independence, at least for the next 4 years. Piłsudski carried the banner for the Polish Socialist Party, PPS, Polska Partia Socjalistyczna, which saw federalism as the way forward with its traditionalist elitist philosophy of different ethnic groups coming together under the Polish flag. Dmowski had much humbler origins and was much more of a modern Pole who sought to empower the masses in pursuit of a homogeneous Polish identity to go along with the new state. His ideas centered on what he saw as the cultural core elements of the Polish people and extended the concept beyond national borders. He had no time for Piłsudski's idea of a new Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. Differences between the two, who were forced to work together after the war, were to dominate Polish history for the next few years. Józef Piłsudski had been born in Lithuania, the son of impoverished Polish aristocrats. In 1887 he had been swept up in Russian police operations to unmask the plotters who had tried to assassinate Tsar Alexander III and had spent 5 years in Siberian exile. After spending some time in England, he was committed to a mental hospital in St. Petersburg, from which he escaped and fled to Japan. Back in Poland, he dabbled in revolutionary politics, but the crushing of the 1907 revolution in Russia left him yearning for elite, disciplined organization that he swore to realize or perish. To finance his ambitions for an independent Poland, he turned to crime and held up a mail train just outside Vilno in April 1908. For years he would bestride Polish life, but he had a complex character. He was a conspirator, not a statesman, whose first instinct in any difficult situation was to fight. But above all, he was a wayward, reckless, rude, vindictive, childish, taciturn, and unpredictable maverick, whose political life would be strewn with blunders and failures. Roman Stanisław Domowski was born to working-class parents near Warsaw in 1864. Like Piłsudski, he fell foul of the Russian police and spent 5 months in prison for political activism before being exiled in Latvia. His disdain for the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, with its reverence for nobility and tolerance of minorities, which he saw as weakening national identity, clearly illustrated the political differences between him and Piłsudski. Over time, Domowski came to favour an accommodation with Russia to form an alliance to combat the threat from Germany. On 6 August 1914, Piłsudski led his first cadre company into the area of Kielce, which the Russian army had evacuated, in the hope of breaking through to Warsaw and starting a nationwide revolution. He established Polish institutions in liberated towns, and soon afterwards the Polish legions were formed in Galicia subordinate to Austrian control. By the summer of 1915, the legions had expanded to 3 brigades, totaling 20,000 to 25,000 soldiers. Piłsudski commanded the 1st Brigade, and during the first 2 years of war, the legions fought in Lesser Poland, the Eastern Carpathians, Lublin, and Volhynia. At the same time, he set up the Polish military organization, Polska Organizacja Wojskowa, an intelligence agency, to carry out espionage and sabotage missions against Russia, whose forces were devastating whole swaths of Polish countryside with scorched earth tactics as German forces drove them back to the east. The Germans, however, also stripped the land of raw materials and machinery for its war machine, but did allow a Polish administration to take control of justice and education. Piłsudski now saw Polish interests being better served by closer ties with Germany, whose banks had historically invested heavily in Polish industry. In mid-1916, after the Battle of Kostiuchnowka, during which heroic Polish forces were heavily outnumbered by the Russians and took very serious losses, Piłsudski called on the Central Powers to issue a guarantee of independence for Poland, which Emperors Wilhelm II of Germany and Franz Joseph of Austria were happy to do, as they hoped to increase the number of Polish troops available to bolster German forces on the Western Front. On the following day, the Provincial Council of State was created, with Václav Józef Niemojowski as its president and Piłsudski as chairman of its military commission. In this role, Piłsudski insisted that his men be deployed only against the Russians, but the German military governor Hans von Beseler took very little notice of his wishes, calling Piłsudski a military dilettante and a demagogue. The Germans showed no inclination to address the question of Polish independence, but found themselves having to deal with it due to the fate of battles. They suggested various measures, including the radical idea of deporting 16 million Poles into Russia and filling the vacated regions with German settlers to create a buffer zone. In the end, Piłsudski set up a regency council, but it had undefined territorial and constitutional rights and found itself entirely subordinated to the German military authority. Despite initial euphoria at the setting up of the Regency Council, there was disappointment that no agreement had been arrived at to define what the borders of the Polish state would be, and there had been no discussion about who the future monarch of the new state would be. It soon became clear that the Central Powers negotiators had been interested only in acquiring more troops, and had no interest in the Polish question as such, and in subsequent months, where Polish institutions of public administration, such as the Provisional Council of State, the Regency Council, and even the government, were established, they were treated as no more than advisory boards to the occupying authorities. In 1915, when the Germans had taken Warsaw, Dmowski's PNC had been forced to move to Petrograd, St. Petersburg. He soon became impatient with the lack of progress in talks with the Russians over Polish independence, which had foundered on the inconvenient reality that most Polish lands were under German occupation, and turned instead to the French for support to internationalize the issue. But first he went to London. There he wasted no time in denigrating Piłsudski as pro-German and promising to bring 500,000 Polish troops to fight for the Western Allies if they would support the creation of an independent Poland. Neither France nor Britain, however, was ready to think of the Polish question as anything other than an internal matter for Russia, but politics there were in flux as the first of the two Bolshevik revolutions swept through Russia in 1917 and forced Tsar Nicholas II to abdicate. The Bolsheviks promised an independent Poland but were in no position to deliver it, and never actually defined what it understood by Poland. The introduction of US troops onto the Western Front and the February Revolution in Russia in 1917 fundamentally altered the dynamics of the war, and the Western Allies, albeit reluctantly, stepped up the pressure on Germany by declaring in favour of an independent Poland. In September 1917, the French recognised Dmowski's Polish National Committee as the legitimate representative of the Polish state, with Britain, Italy, and the US following suit by the end of the year, but not without British reservations over the elevated role of Dmowski as putative leader of the Polish state. The 500,000 Polish troops turned out to be no more than 100,000, and these would later come under the command of Josef Haller, who had commanded Piłsudski's 3rd Legion when he arrived from Murmansk in October 1918. Piłsudski now felt that it was time to take stock and reassess his decision to support the Central Powers. When von Beseler called for all Polish troops to swear an oath of loyalty that obliged them to transfer their allegiance from Austria to Germany, Piłsudski saw his chance to break away from the hold Germany had over the Poles and ordered his legionnaires to refuse. Despite von Beseler tempting Piłsudski with promises of power, fame, and money, the Pole replied, "Do you imagine for one moment that you will win the nation's confidence by hanging Polish insignia on each of the fingers of the hand which is throttling Poland?" As a result, the 1st and 3rd Polish legions were dissolved, and the legionnaires from Russian-occupied territories were imprisoned in camps in Szczypiorno near Kalisz, in Beniaminów near Zegrze, and in Łomża, while the Austrian subjects were incorporated into the Austro-Hungarian army and sent to the Italian front. Only the soldiers of the 2nd Brigade, most of them Austrian subjects, swore an oath and continued to fight the Russians, alongside the Austro-Hungarian army, as the Polish Auxiliary Corps, commanded by Josef Haller and Władysław Sikorski. Piłsudski and his chief of staff, Colonel Kazimierz Sosnokowski, were arrested by the Germans in Warsaw on the morning of 22 July 1917. Von Beseler now considered Piłsudski to be a major threat to peace and stability in the country, and after the outbreak of the February Revolution in Russia in 1917, much of the fighting had ceased on the Russo-Volhynia-German front, and it was generally accepted in Germany that there was no further necessity to feign solidarity with the Poles. Piłsudski and Sosnokowski were transferred to Gdansk and then Berlin, where they were separated but both incarcerated in the prison in Wilhelmstrasse in Spandau near Berlin. On 6 August 1917, they were again moved, again separately, to the fortress in Wesel on the Lower Rhine, near the border to Holland. After only 2 weeks, as a result of protests by Piłsudski's supporters at the conditions there, he was transferred to Magdeburg. The internationally famous concert pianist Ignacy Jan Paderewski had become a spokesman for Dmowski's Polish.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?